Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Yare by Manly Wade Wellman. There were four in the last gray of evening by the wind-blown coals of the fire with utensils propped ready. Trees tufted the slope below Blackham Mountain, with grassy stretches between. Young Hal Stryker felt privileged to be there. He let the others study his flowing sandy hair and his patched jean. "This here is Hal Stryker, the feller I'd said I'd fetch," Poke Jendal introduced them when they arrived. "Hal, shake hands with Seth Worley and with this here beardy one. He's Reed Lufbrug. He makes a good distilled blockade. It looks to me he fetched on some in a jug. Seth and Reed, Hal's a lowlander who wants to see how we do things up here in the mountains."
"Such as this fox hunt?" amplified Stryker. "I've heard about you, how you hunt foxes, but it's better to see a thing done than hear about it."
"Twer words was ne'er spoke," approved Seth Worley, lean as a hunting knife, and as ready looking with his black hair and plowshare jaw. Jendal was the smallest man there, but hard-knit, shrewd about his horsey face, with broad hands that were wise with guns, tools, and especially with a banjo. Lufbrog was the oldest, with thinning gray hair, a bush of beard, mustaches that curled like buffalo horns. They sat on square chunks of rock, rough-clad, good-humored. All had brought guns but Stryker. These were laid carefully within quick reach of hands. Tied to nearby roots, strained half a dozen dogs. All but one were brown-blotched hounds. The exception was of a Scandinavian breed, heavy-furred with ears that stood up expectantly.
"Them dogs is ready to go," declared Worley, "and I aim to hark at them a-runnin' something down tonight."
He arranged the joints of two chickens in a skillet above the coals. Poke Jendal stirred meal and water and salt into another skillet for Pone. Lufbrog unstoppered his jug. Each drank in turn, with a jug draped on a forearm.
"Good," Stryker praised the sharp tang of the liquor.
"Better'n the government whiskey," said Lufbrog. "Pure as spring water. Not touched it but the wood of the keg and the copper of the still and the clay of the jug."
Stryker studied the rock on which he sat.
"It looks as if a house was built here once."
"Long years back," nodded Jendal above the pone. "Feller they called Yare lived here. His house is gone, and so's he. I don't recollect him. He was before my time."
"What kind of name is Yare?" wondered Stryker.
"Just only a nickname, I reckon," said Jendal.
"I don't know his true name. Folks just called him Yare.
I was a young chap when Yare was a usin' around hereabouts," contributed Lufbrog, the jug in his lap. "He comes from somewhere's outland. He allowed he loved the animals and hated the hunters."
"How did that suit the people?" asked Stryker, who was no enthusiastic huntsman himself.
"They fussed with him, and he fussed with them," replied Lufbrog. "He had powers from somewhere, I heard say. Could fetch down a rain by singing a certain song. Could kill a crop in the field if so happened he didn't like the feller who planted it."
"My old daddy done told me about him," elaborated Jendal above his cooking. "If you killed a deer, he set his big old handprint in blood onto your door, and the blood wouldn't dry. Would drip and drip for days."
"I've heard that same thing," said Worley, shaking dark powder into the chicken gravy. "This ain't no poison spell, boys. Just some instant coffee. It goes good that-a-way."
"Well, but you say this Yare is dead," said Stryker.
"So folks say," said Lufbrog. "Me, I ain't near heard tale of where his grave might have been dug."
Jendal took knife and fork and cautiously turned the cake of pone in his skillet. "Near about time to set them dogs on," he said.
"I'll do that," volunteered Worley, rising and unsnapping the leashes from the collars. He walked a few steps with the dogs until they bunched and sniffed the ground attentively. Then they sprang away, noses to earth. They ran towards where, about the distant hunch of Blackham Mountain, rose a pale melon of a moon. The men watched them. "When are you about ready to eat?" said Jendal at last. He cut wedges of pone and slid them onto paper plates. Whirly forked on juicy pieces of chicken. Lofbrog passed out iron knives and fork. Stryker bit into the chicken. It was as savory as Whirly had promised. Away in the dimness, a dog bayed tremulously, musically. "That there's Tromp," Jendal informed them. "I'd know him amongst a thousand." "Don't you follow them?" Stryker suggested. "Ne'er a step, son," said Lofbrog, spooning gravy on his pone. "Not this here bunch of smart dogs. We sit and hark at them a-singin', and directly they fetch what they're after back to us here, close to where it wants to hole up." "I hear tell the lowlands hunters right after a fox with red coats on," said Gentle. "A sight of trouble to do that." Another dog's voice pealed like a bell. "That's my gift," Whirly told them. "When he talks up that-a-way, the trail's hot. They're good piece off from here already." "They'll fetch him back," predicted Lofbrog, gnawing on a drumstick. Stryker ate pone and gravy. "What you said about that man, Yara, is interesting," he prompted. "I know you, Hal," grinned Yendel. "You enjoy to hear about hants and witches and all like that." "You say he lived here, right where we are now?" "His house got burnt off. These here very stones," said Lofbrog. "Why?" asked Stryker. "Folks didn't much like Yara." They watched Stryker and he smiled. As Jendel had said, he liked this sort of story, here in this sort of place, at this time of the night with the dogs baying at a distance. "Why didn't they like him?" he asked, because they waited for him to ask it. "Well, he fussed with folks about hunting," said Lofbrog between mouthful. "He loved animals, another sight better than folks, wild animals, that is. Yara didn't value cows or chickens or hogs, said they was tame, deserved to die. Folks figured he stole such things at night and ate them up. But he hated deer killing, coon killing, even fish catching." "Did he have any family?" asked Stryker. "A wife?" "Ne'er girl would have looked at him," said Lofbrog. "Harry, the way he was." "How hairy was that?" "All over," replied Lofbrog. "Not just the beard like mine. His face was all hair. Even the nose. The one, two times I seen him. And his arms, his hands, a-sticking out of his old clothes, they was hairy too, like a bear or a wildcat. Dark hair, no shine to it. Pure down ugly to look at," Lofbrog bit into the drumstick. "Better off dead, if he is dead." "He'd have to be better than 100 by now," said Gentle. "My old granddaddy lived past 100, Whirly said. "Walked a couple of miles a-gathering walnuts the morning the day he died." "And Yara was long and tall," resumed Lofbrog. "Must have been near 7 feet, with long arms. They like to drag on the ground." Stryker was silent, trying to visualize such a figure. Jendal ate chicken and pone. "Like what I say, I wasn't around here when he was," he said, "but a heap of folks said Yara wasn't true human blood. He'd been born of some kind of devil blood." "He looked devilish enough," endorsed Lofbrog. "And cut up devilish enough. Scared folks. Maybe even killed a couple of fellers." "I've heard tell that a couple of hunter near come home from time to time," nodded Whirly. "Nobody found their bodies." "Nobody found Yara's body," said Lofbrog. Remotely, the dogs lifted their voice together like a choir. "They're sure enough on to something," said Gentle. "They're trying now to catch up on it." They finished eating to the remote music. Jendal threw scraps into the fire, which crackled hungrily. Lofbrog passed the jug again. The moon soared well above Blackham Mountain. "Now, hark at them dogs," said Whirly. The chorus lifted far off to one side, as though the pack were following a trail along the slope. Joy was in the voices and deadly intent. "They reckon they're getting close," decided Whirly. "Soon's they can see what they're after, they'll purely get a move on." The clarion voices rang together, then all died out but one. "Tromp," Jendal identified it. "He must be leading the way just now." Those cries grew fainter. "They're heading away after it, but they'll fetch it, sure enough. Back here," said Lofbrog confidently. Somebody want another wet out of this here jug?
It went the rounds.
Now, said Stryker, what about the question of whether this Yara is dead or not?
Oh, hell, said Worley, wiping his mouth. You know how some folks are talking. They'll tell you that their corn dies down with a blight, or their dogs go mad and have to be shot, and they figure Yara's got something to do with it, or they see something at the window and get pestered about that.
I've heard such stuff as that, chimed in Jendal. How if he comes up and looks in at your window, somebody in your family dies.
Do you hold with that, Poke? Inquired Lufbrock.
Ne'er said I did, but I know folks that does.
Worley drank again. All right, he addressed Stryker.
Wind's been a-telling you tales. It's your turn now.
Tell us some of these here things, Poke says, you've seen and done.
Do that thing, Hal encouraged Jendal.
Stryker did so, somewhat hesitantly. He told of how he had managed to destroy an evil spirit that haunted an ancient stage house on a half-forgotten road, and of how he had managed to get into a remote cabin, literally besieged by evil, cunning trees, and then had managed to get out again. As he spoke, he watched his companions. They acted as though they were weighing every word he spoke.
"Chew," said Jendal at last. "You done more things than e'er one of us has, Hal, and the thing of it must have sure enough done something for you."
Remotely, the dogs bayed on their resolute quest.
"What do you mean by that?" Stryker demanded.
"You went up against Hans, and all like that. You whooped them.
That means you found out how."
"I don't see that I have," said Stryker, mystified.
"Like when you're in a war," offered Lufbrock.
"They train you, they give you a gun, call you a soldier.
Only you ain't no such thing, no soldier, till you've been in where the shooting is and seen the monkey show, so to speak it."
The dog sang to them again. Far away, they're somewhere. They sounded more excited, less lighthearted.
"Hark at them," spoke up Worley. "They might could have caught a glimpse of what they want to catch up with."
A series of half-screaming yelps.
"Old Trump's a-telling the others he'll lead," Jendal said approvingly.
"Son," said Lufbrog to Stryker's voice weighty. "What you tell us gives me the thought you're what we've been a-needing here in the Black Ham neighborhood."
"Me?" Stryker half cried out.
"You done been a-studying these things," said Lufbrog. "You can figure what to do in some cases."
The fire flickered there among them, lighting the faces that looked at Stryker.
Jendal put wood on the blaze. It fought briefly with the fuel, then sent up tongues of flame yellow as butter. The dog sang to them again. They sounded nearer by now.
"What does all this have to do with fox hunting?" Stryker asked.
"Fox hunting," said Lufbrog after him.
"Who said aught about foxes?" inquired Worley.
"Why," Stryker stammered,
"why, I came out here with Poke because you're going to hunt a fox."
"I ne'er said pea turkey to you about foxes," said Poke solemnly.
"Back yonder at my place, I said we were bringing out our dogs here tonight, and did you relish to come along?"
"Are you having some kind of fun with me?" challenged Stryker, half angrily.
"No, Hal," Jendal's voice was patient. "I might could have fooled you up a tad, but we're dead serious about this. On account of them strange things you narrated to us, we'd had the word on you about them before now."
"Them witches enhancing them," added Worley, "and you're being able to do something about them if they come up pestering you?"
Stryker stared at them from one solemn face to another.
"Well," he said slowly, "I've had some unusual experiences. I didn't think you'd believe them."
"We believe," said Lufbrog. "We come out here to believe. Look, son," and his beard jetted emphatically, "that's why we had Poke to fetch you out with us tonight."
I don't get it," groaned Stryker, fidgeting on his rock.
"Ain't it a natural fact that if a man's had them experiences you say you had," said Jendal, "been up against such things and made out to handle them such way, he's got a power, ain't he?"
"What Poke means," said Worley from his own rock, "he can do away with such things."
"That's the old supposition," admitted Stryker, feeling a chill in his stomach.
"Look, Hal," urged Jendal, "hark at me good. It ain't no fox that we come out here tonight to have the dogs run."
"God's name, what is it then?"
"Shoo," said Jendal. "We've been a-talking about that. It's Yari we fetched them out after."
The dogs bayed, and the sound of baying was stronger. It was nearer. Stryker jumped his feet.
"If this is a joke," he began.
"If it was a joke, it'd be a plumb foolish one," said Jendal. "It ain't ne'er joke, Hal. We mean the last mumbling word of it." They sat on those rocks that once had held up a house, sat like a panel of judges passing sentence on them. The moonlight picked out their faces. "We come out here to track up Banyari once for all," said Jendal, "to stop what he does hereabouts. And you're the one as a going to stop it for us." "You're all out of your heads," cried Stryker. "If that's a fact," said Lufbrock, "you'll have the chance to find out directly, because they're running Yara in here to us like a fox to his hole." The voices of the pack rose louder, louder, building a crescendo. "They can see him now," said Worley expertly. "They're running him fast." "And he wants to hole up right where we are," said Jendal. "Where he used to live, Hal. I said it's up to you." "Up to you, son," said Lufbrog, as though he pronounced a benediction. The excited clamor of the chase grew louder. Across open ground toward them came something swift as a shadow. It was big and black, Stryker saw, as he faced towards it. A bear or a midnight bull would be that size. The dogs thronged after it, leaping to close in. The others had risen, their rifles in their hands. Stryker, weaponless, snatched a pole from the stack of firewood. It was perhaps 4 feet long, sharpened to a rough point. It might help in a fight. A fight. His blood stirred at the thought. He stepped away from the fire. The ground seemed to quake under him. Whatever the something was, had come near enough to see. It came swiftly at a crouch, huddled and huge. Its long forelimbs swept like shaggy wings close to the ground. Suddenly it rose erect in front of him. It loomed like a rearing horse. It plunged uncouthly against the night sky, those great shaggy arms outflung. Stars winked around it. He wondered why nobody fired, and it occurred to him that shots might not hurt it. It closed in. Rake-like paws swooped at him. The moonlight touched what might be a face higher up, dark and tufted except for pale crumbs of eyes, so close set that they almost merged, jagged picket rows of teeth. Then the dogs were upon its bushy flanks. It screamed deafeningly and floundered back from Stryker, its paws slapping right and left. He caught a pale shimmer through the fur on one arm, a glint as of ivory. A dog yelped in agony as it flew through the air like a blown leaf. The grotesque hugeness shook itself free from the pack and clumped toward Stryker again. A wave of foul stench smote his nostrils, so overwhelming that he tottered as at a blow. The shaggy shape rose against the sky. The coat of hair rippled. He had another glimpse of streaky pallor, like a row of naked ribs. Desperately, he swung the pole with both hands. The blow rang where it struck, as though on a dull gong. The creature did not even flinch under the impact. It clawed for him. His shirt ripped, and he threw himself backwards and fell head over heels. As he rolled over and came up on one knee, it towered above him again. It hunched great shoulders, bannered with black hair. It stung so strongly that Stryker's eyes swam, the talons scooped for him. He whirled the pointed pole and his hands sharp and forward. He jabbed frantically and the murky bulk dodged away. The dog snarled and yelped and danced all around. "Yari," he cried its name at it, and it knew its name. It heaved its shoulder and snarled back at him. Who was Yari? What had Yari become? This floundering, looming entity, wing-armed, talon-fingered, was grown out of Yari, who had loved the wild, had hated tame mankind. It wanted to fight. It must be fought. This dark blotch and the dancing glow of the moon. Somehow he got the pole in position. Again he jabbed, trying without real hope to keep the murky bulk away. He saw the shaggy face open up with teeth like a monstrous skull. It slammed itself at him. His pointed pole struck into something as into earth. Above his head rang a deafening scream of startled pain. The stench welled around him like a foul torrent. The ramming force of his thrust had brought him to his feet again. He surged forward with a pull. The giant shadow almost enveloped him. Then abruptly it gave back. With all his summoned strength, he drove the pole in and in. It had flundered down. It sprawled and thrashed there. A paw raked upward at him. He felt the sting of talons on his cheek. Leaning all his weight on the pole, he felt it strike into something other than what he had transfixed, into earth, pinning the shape there like a gigantic insect upon a card. His mind churned within him, and he staggered away and slammed to the grass. He dreamed horribly of something. His senses returned to him furtively, as though they were not quite sure that they should come back. Voices chattered. Then he felt hands upon him. He blinked his eyes, and he could see. Jendo was on one side of him, helping him to his feet. Whirly came up on the other, an arm around him. "He sure enough gouged you," Jendo babbled. "Looks like as if a knife come on your cheek. Let me have that there jug, Reed." Lufbrog passed it to Jendo, who sloshed it at Stryker's face. The liquor stung sharply and helped clear his head. He touched his face timidly. It was wet with blood, with the whiskey. "None of you got into the fight," Stryker said. "None of us could have done aught," Lufbrog replied. "It was up to you." "Got a clean handkerchief?" Worley asked, his hands at Stryker's pocket. "Here you are. Hold it there. I'll stanch up the blood." Stryker wadded the handkerchief against the wound. "What happened?" "What happened?" Lufbrog echoed him. "You done what we fetched you here to do. You finished Yare off." Stryker looked at Jendal for some sort of enlightenment. "Yonder he lies," Jendal pointed. "When you got up against him with just a stick, we wondered ourselves if things hadn't gone against us. But you stuck him right through where he was biggest. Spiked him to the ground. No, Hal, don't go over yonder." "He's dead," said Whirly. "Dead all the way through," amplified Lufbrog. "All the way back along them years. He stinks rotten." Stryker gazed. The gray shadowy form lay motionless in the soft moonlight. Around it capered the dogs, weaving a pattern. They did not venture too near. "He appears like to be just bones inside his skin," said Lufbrog. "Not even them dogs want air part of him." "He done slapped my gift clean out of his life," mumbled Whirly miserably. "Crushed him like a duck egg." "That there's too bad, Seth," Lufbrog comforted him. "I know you valued that there dog a right much. Thought the world of him. Too bad it happened." All of them walked away from the patterned rocks, the motionless fallen bulk of what had been something called Yare. "You know, fellas," said Lufbrog, "that there pole that Hal Stryker took into the fight with him? It was an ash pole." "Ash pole," Stryker echoed him tonelessly. "Sure thing, ash. I've heard talk old Indian fellas around here. They used to allow ash was something you could use to fight evil spirits with. It must have done its part just now." Stryker mopped his bloody, sweaty face. Wearily, he walked along with the others. The dogs followed them, all but one that lay limply apart from the larger dead mass. "What shall we do with the body?" Stryker asked all three of them at once. "How?" said Jendo. "We won't do aught with it. We'll just leave it where it is," second Lufbrog. Already, there was a considerable distance from where those things had happened. They quickened their feet. They headed towards where a tiny point of radiance made a token of a cabin in the night. Kevin Malone by Gene Wolfe. Marcella and I were married in April. I lost my position with Ketterly, Bruce, and Drake in June, and by August we were desperate. We kept the apartment. I think we both felt that if we lowered our standards, there would be no chance to raise them again. But the rent tore at our small savings. All during July, I had tried to get a job at another brokerage firm. And by August, I was calling fraternity brothers I had not seen since graduation and expressing an entire willingness to work in whatever business their fathers owned. One of them, I think, must have mailed us the advertisement. Attractive young couple, well-educated and well-connected, will receive free housing, generous living allowance for minimal services. There was a telephone number, which I omit for reasons that will become clear. I showed the clipping to Marcella, who was lying with her cocktail shaker on the Chase Lounge. She said, "Why not?" And I dialed the number. The telephone buzzed in my ear, paused, and buzzed again. I allowed myself to go limp in my chair. It seemed absurd to call at all. For the advertisement to have reached us that day, it must have appeared no later than yesterday morning. If the position were worth having, the Pines? I pulled myself together. "You placed a classified ad for an attractive couple, well-educated, and the rest of it?" "I did not, sir. However, I believe my master did. I am Priest, the butler." I looked at Marcella, but her eyes were closed. "Do you know, Priest, if the opening has been filled?" "I think not, sir. May I ask your age?" I told him. At his request, I also told him Marcella's. She was 2 years younger than I. And gave him the names of the schools we had attended, described our appearance, and mentioned that my grandfather had been a governor of Virginia and that Marcella's uncle had been ambassador to France. I did not tell him that my father had shot himself rather than face bankruptcy or that Marcella's family had disowned her, but I suspect he guessed well enough what her situation was. You will forgive me, sir, for asking so many questions. We are almost a half-day's drive, and I would not wish you to be disappointed. I told them that I appreciated that, and we set a date, Tuesday of the next week, on which Marcel and I were to come out for an interview with the master. Priest had hung up before I realized that I had failed to learn his employer's name. During the teens and twenties, some very wealthy people had designed estates in imitation of the palaces of the Italian Renaissance. The Pines was one of them, and better preserved than most. The fountain in the courtyard still played, the marbles were clean and unyellowed, and if no red-robed cardinal descended the steps to a carriage blazoned with the Borgia arm, one felt that he had only just gone. No doubt the place had originally been called La Capanna or Ermitaggio. A serious-looking man in a dark livery opened the door for us. For a moment he stared at us across the threshold. "Very well," he said. "I beg your pardon?" I said, "You are looking very well." He nodded to each of us in turn and stood aside. "Sir, madam, I am priest. Will your master be able to see us?" For a moment, some exiled expression, it might have been amusement, seemed to tug at his solemn face. "The music room, perhaps, sir?" I said I was sure that would be satisfactory, and followed him. The music room held a Steinway, a harp, and a dozen or so comfortable chairs. It overlooked the rose garden, in which old Remontant varieties were beginning that second season that is more opulent though less generous than the first. A kneeling gardener was weeding one of the beds. "This is a wonderful house," Marcel said. "I really didn't think there was anything like it left. I told him you'd have done a John Collins, all right. You were looking at the roses. Perhaps we ought to get the job first. I can't call him back now, and if we don't get it, at least we will have had drinks." I nodded to that. In 5 minutes they arrived, and we drank them and smoked cigarettes we found in a humidor, English cigarettes of a strong Turkish tobacco. A maid came and said that Mr. Priest would be much obliged if we would let him know when we would dine. I told her that we would eat whenever it was convenient, and she dropped a little curtsy and withdrew. "At least," Marcella commented, "he's making us comfortable while we wait." Dinner was lamb and aspic and a salad with a maid, another maid and footman to serve while Priest stood by to see that it was done properly. We ate at either side of a small table on a terrace overlooking another garden where antique statues faded to white glimmerings as the sun set. Priest came forward to light the candles. "Will you require me after dinner, sir?" "Will your employer require us? That's the question." "Bateman can show you to your room, sir. When you are ready to retire, Julia will see to Madame." I looked at the footman, who was carrying fruit in on a tray. "No, sir, that is Carter. Bateman is your man." "And Julia," Marcella put in, "is my maid, I suppose?" "Precisely, Priest," gave an almost inaudible cough. "Perhaps, sir and madam, you might find this useful." He drew a photograph from an inner pocket and handed it to me. It was a black and white snapshot, somewhat dog-eared. 2 dozen people, most of them in livery of one kind or another, stood in brilliant sunshine on the steps at the front of the house, men behind women. There were names in India ink across the bottom of the picture: James Sutton, Edna de Buck, Lloyd Bateman. "Our staff, sir." I said, "Thank you, Priest. No, you needn't stay tonight." The next morning, Bateman shaved me in bed. He did it very well, using a straight razor and scented soap applied with a brush. I had heard of such things. I think of my grandfather's valet may have shaved him like that before the First World War, but I never guessed that anyone kept up the tradition. Bateman did, and I found I enjoyed it. When he had dressed me, he asked if I would breakfast in my room. "I doubt it," I said. "Do you know my wife's plans?" "I think it likely she will be on the south terrace, sir. Julia said something to that effect as I was bringing in your water." "I'll join her then." "Of course, sir," he hesitated. "I don't think I'll require a guide, but you might tell my wife I'll be with her in 10 minutes or so." Bateman repeated his, "Of course, sir," and went out. The truth was that I wanted to assure myself that everything I had carried in the pockets of my old suit, car keys, wallet, and so on, had been transferred to the new one he had laid out for me, and I did not want to insult him if I could prevent it, by doing it in front of him. Everything was where it should be, and I had a clean handkerchief in place of my only slightly soiled one. I pulled it out to look at Irish linen, and a flutter of green came with it. Two bills, both 50s. Over Ex Benedict, I complimented Marcella on her new dress and asked if she had noticed where it had been made. Rose, it's a little shop on Fifth Avenue. You know it then? Nothing unusual? She answered, no, nothing unusual, more quickly than she should have, and I knew that there had been money in her new clothes too, and that she did not intend to tell me about it. We'll be going home after this. I wonder if they'll want me to give this jacket back. Going home? She did not look up from her plate. Why? And who are they? Whoever owns this house. Yesterday you called him he. You said Priest talked about the master, so that seemed logical enough. Today you're afraid to deal with even presumptive masculinity. I said nothing. You think he spent the night in my room? They separated us, and you thought that was why, and you just waited there? Was it under a sheet, for me to scream or something, and I didn't? I was hoping you had, and I hadn't heard you. Nothing happened, damn it. I went to bed and went to sleep. But as for going home, you're out of your mind. Can't you see we've got the job? Whoever he is, wherever he is, he likes us. We're going to stay here and live like human beings, at least for a while. And so we did. That day we stayed on from hour to hour. After that, from day to day, and then at last from week to week. I felt like Clip Springer, the man who was Jay Gatsby's guest for so long that he had no other home. Except that Clip Springer presumably saw Gatsby from time to time and no doubt made agreeable conversation and perhaps even played the piano for him. Our Gatsby was absent. I do not mean that we avoided him or that he avoided us. There were no rooms where we were forbidden to enter and no times when the servants seemed eager that we should play golf or swim or go riding. Before the good weather ended, we had two couples up for a weekend, and when Bette Wingassen asked if Marcella had inherited the place and then if we were renting it, Marcella said, oh, do you like it? In such a way that they left, I think convinced that it was ours, or as good as ours. And so it was. We went away when we chose, which was seldom, and returned when we chose quickly. We ate on the various terraces and balconies and in the big formal dining room and in our own bedrooms. We rode the horses and drove the Mercedes and the cranky, appealing old Jaguar as though they were our own. We did everything, in fact, except buy the groceries and pay the taxes and the servants. But someone else was doing that. And every morning, I found $100 in the pockets of my clean clothes. If summer had lasted forever, perhaps I would still be there. The poplars lost their leaves in one October week. At the end of it, I fell asleep listening to the hum of the pump that emptied the swimming pool. When the rain came, Marcella turned sour and drank too much. One evening, I made the mistake of putting my arm about her shoulders as we sat before the fire in the trophy room. Get your filthy hands off me, she said. I don't belong to you. Priest, look here. He hasn't said an intelligent word to me all day or done a decent thing, and now he wants to paw me all night. Priest pretended, of course, that he had not heard her. Look over here. Damn it. You're a human being, aren't you? He did not ignore that. Yes, madam, I am a human being. I'll say you are. You're more a man than he is. This is your place, and you're keeping us for pets. Is it me you want, or him? You sent us the ad, didn't you? He thinks you go into my room at night, or he says he does. Maybe you really come to his. Is that it? Peace did not answer. I said, for God's sake, Marcella. Even if you're old priest, I think you're too much of a man for that. She stood up tottering on her long legs and holding onto the stonework of the fireplace. If you want me, take me. If this house is yours, you can have me. We'll send him to Vegas or throw him on the dump. In a much softer tone than he usually used, Priest said, I don't want either of you, madam. I stood up then and caught him by the shoulders. I had been drinking too, though only half or a quarter as much as Marcella, but I think it was more than that. It was the accumulated frustration Of all the days since Jim Bruce told me, I was finished. I outweighed Priest by at least 40 pounds, and I was 20 years younger, I said. I want to know. Release me, sir, please. I want to know who it is. I want to know now. Do you see that fire? Tell me, Priest, or I swear I'll throw you in it. His face tightened at that. Yes, he whispered, and I let go of his shoulders. It was not the lady, sir. It was you. I want that understood this time. What the hell are you talking about? I'm not doing this because of what she said. You aren't the master, are you? For God's sake, tell the truth. I've always told the truth, sir. No, I am not the master. Do you remember the picture I gave you? I nodded. You discarded it. I took the liberty, sir, of rescuing it from the waste can in your bedroom. I have it here. He reached into his coat and pulled it out, just as he had on the first day, and handed it to me. It's one of these? One of the servants? Priest nodded and pointed with an impeccably manicured forefinger to the figure at the extreme right of the second row. The name beneath it was Kevin Malone. Him? Silently, Priest nodded again. I had examined the picture on the night he had given it to me, but had never paid special attention to that particular half-inch-high image. The person it represented might have been a gardener, a man of middle age, short, and perhaps stocky. A soft sweat-stained hat cast a shadow on his face. I want to see him. I looked towards Marcella, still leaning against the stonework of the mantel. We want to see him. Are you certain, sir? Damn you! Get him! Priest remained where he was staring at me. I was so furious that I think I might have seized him as I had threatened and pushed him into the fire. Then the French windows opened and there came a gust of wind. For an instant, I think I expected a ghost or some turbulent elemental spirit. I felt that pricking at the neck that comes when one reads Poe alone at night. The man I had seen in the picture stepped into the room. He was a small and very ordinary man in worn khaki, but he left the windows wide behind him so that the night entered with him and remained in the room for as long as we talked. You own this house, I said. You're Kevin Malone? He shook his head. I am Kevin Malone. This house owns me. Marcella was standing straighter now, drunk yet still at that stage of drunkenness in which she was conscious of her condition and could compensate for it. It owns me too, she said, and walking almost normally, she crossed the room to the baronial chair Malone had chosen and managed to sit down at his feet. My father was the man of all work here. My mother was the parlor maid. I grew up here, washing the cars and raking leaves out of the fountains. Do you follow me? Where did you grow up? I shrugged. Various places, Richmond, New York, 3 years in Paris. Until I was sent off to school, we lived in hotels, mostly. You see, then, you can understand, Malone smiled for a moment. You're still recreating the life you had as a child, or trying to, isn't that right? None of us can be happy any other way, and few of us even want to try. Thomas Wolfe said you can't go home again, I ventured. That's right, you can't go home. There's one place where we can never go. Haven't you thought of that? We can dive to the bottom of the sea, and someday NASA will fly us to the stars, and I've known men to plunge into the past, or the future, and drown. But there's one place where we can't go. We can't go where we are already. We can't go home because our minds and our hearts and our mortal souls are already there. Not knowing what to say, I nodded, and what seemed to satisfy him. Priest looked as calm as ever, but he made no move to shut the windows, and I sensed that he was somehow afraid. I was put into an orphanage when I was 12, but I never forgot the pines. I used to tell the other kids about it, and it got bigger and better every year, but I knew what I said could never equal the reality. He shifted in his seat, and the slight movement of his legs set Marcella sprawling, passed out. She retained a certain grace still. I have always understood that it is the reward of studying ballet as a child. Malone continued to talk. They'll tell you it's no longer possible for a poor boy with a second-rate education to make a fortune. Well, it takes luck, but I had it. It also takes the willingness to risk it all. I had that too, because I knew that for me, anything under a fortune was nothing. I had to be able to buy this place, to come back and buy the pines, and staff it and maintain it. That's what I wanted. and nothing less would make any difference. "You're to be congratulated," I said, "but why?" He laughed. It was a deep laugh, but there was no humor in it. "Why don't I wear a tie and eat my supper at the end of the big table?" I tried it. I tried it for nearly a year, and every night I dreamed of home. That wasn't home, you see. Wasn't the Pines? Home is three rooms above the stables. I live there now. I live at home as a man should. It seems to me that it would have been a great deal simpler for you to have applied for the job you fill now. Malone shook his head impatiently. That wouldn't have done it at all. I had to have control. That's something I learned in business, to have control. Another owner would have wanted to change things, and maybe he would even have sold out to a subdivider. No. Besides, when I was a boy, this estate belonged to a fashionable young couple. Suppose a man of my age had bought it. Or a young woman, some whore. His mouth tightened and relaxed. You and your wife were ideal. Now I have to get somebody else, that's all. You can stay the night if you like. I'll have you driven into the city tomorrow morning. I ventured. You needed us as stage properties, then? I'd be willing to stay on those terms. Malone shook his head again. That's out of the question. I don't need props. I need actors. In business, I've put on little shows for the competition, if you know what I mean, and sometimes even for my own people. And I've learned that the only actors who can really do justice to their parts are the ones who don't know what they are. Really, I began. He cut me off with a look. For a few seconds, we stared at one another. Something terrible lived behind those eyes. Frightened despite all reason could tell me, I said, I understand, and stood up. There seemed to be nothing else to do. I'm glad, at least, that you don't hate us. With your childhood, it would be quite natural if you did. Will you explain things to Marcella in the morning? She'll throw herself at you, no matter what I say. He nodded absently. May I ask one more question? I wondered why you had to leave and go into the orphanage. Did your parents die or lose their place? Malone said. Didn't you tell him, priest? It's the local legend. I thought everyone knew. The butler cleared his throat. The elder Mr. Malone, he was the stableman here, sir, though it was before my time. He murdered Betty Malone, who was one of the maids, or at least he was thought to have, sir. They never found the body, and it's possible he was accused falsely. Buried her on the estate, Malone said. They found bloody rags and the hammer, and he hanged himself in the stable. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to pry. The wind whipped the drapes like wine-red flags. They knocked over a vase, and Priest winced, but Malone did not seem to notice. She was 20 years younger and a tramp, he said. Those things happen. I said, yes, I know they do, and went up to bed. I do not know where Marcella slept. Perhaps there on the carpet, perhaps in the room that had been hers, perhaps even in Malone's servant's flat over the stables. I breakfasted alone on the terrace then, without Bateman's assistance, packed my bags. I saw her only once more. She was wearing a black silk dress. There were circles under her eyes, and her head must have been throbbing, but her hand was steady. As I walked out of the house, she was going over the Severs with a peacock feather duster. We did not speak. I've sometimes wondered if I were woefully wrong in anticipating a ghost when the French windows opened. How did Malone know the time had come for him to appear? Of course, I've looked up the newspaper reports of the murder. All the old papers are microfilm at the library, and I have a great deal of time. There is no mention of a child. In fact, I get the impression that the identical surnames of the murderer and his victim were coincidental. Malone is a common enough name, and there are a good many Irish servants then. Sometimes I wonder if it is possible for a man, even a rich man, to be possessed and not to know it.